of your career in the field so far. He's developed and deployed a series of many progressively more innovative technologies. So in the 1990s, it was multi-user domains. In the late 2000s, it was open online communities. And in the 2010s, it is personal learning environments. And I think we're gonna hear about some even more new things today. You may know him from his newsletter, his daily newsletter, OL Daily, which I subscribe to every day and get fantastic information about what's going on in e-learning, in philosophy, I'm also a philosopher, in just general education topics. Stephen also is the originator of the massive open online course. So he did the first MOOC in 2008, Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. So I'm pretty late to all of this. I learned about Connectivism in 2013. So by then it was already,
done.
It was already far old. But that's when I first learned about Stephen and Connectivism, and I had missed the CCK 2008 MOOC. But I did learn about it then and have been following his career and his information ever since. So I'm excited to have finally met him in person. He's given many, many lectures around the world on topics such as recent work in connectivism, trends in e-learning and virtual education, how open education can change the world. So he's also one of the leaders in open education, redesigning education for the future, and many, many more. So today, Stephen is going to talk to us about the third wave, the next generation of distributed learning technology. So please welcome Stephen Downs.
Pardon?
Yeah.
It should be on the computer. It's lost. Hi, everyone. They're searching for my presentation. I have a copy right here if you need it.
Sure.
It was on there somewhere, but it's an Apple machine, so.
It has worms.
It has worms.
First one?
It's the one with today's date. Yeah.
Have you unmuted the mic? The wireless mic? Have you unmuted the wireless mic?
Pardon?
Have you unmuted the wireless mic?
All right. Here's the presenter. And here's my clicker. I believe we have our technology in order. All right. I saw that guy not yesterday, the day before. So, and he very patiently allowed me to take multiple photographs. And for that, I am very appreciative. Because now I have a title slide. Nature at the service of me. So thank you, and it's a pleasure to be back at CNIE. I have a long history coming to these conferences back in the days when it was CADE and AmTech. Some of you may remember that prehistory. I did an AmTech in Regina, which was memorable. CADE in 98 at Banff Center, and another one in St. John's, Newfoundland, which was also memorable. I crashed the CADE conference once when it was held in St. John. Don't tell anybody. But they put me on a panel, and anyhow. So I've always had good memories and good reflections at the CADE conferences, and I'm very happy to be here at CNIE. In beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. That was for the recording. This is being recorded, as you know. So remember, it will be on the internet. Anything you say, do feel free to say things like, no, that's wrong, whatever. But anything you say will be recorded forever. Okay. All right. Without too much ado, because I only have a limited amount of time and I have so much stuff I want to cover. I probably shouldn't cover so much stuff, but this is the third wave, and my apologies to Alvin Toffler for stealing the title. Third Wave was a really influential book on for me back in the 1970s when it came out. It predicted a lot of the things that I get credit for having predicted. So I really appreciated that book. The third wave that I'm talking about isn't Toffler's third wave. It's the next generation of distributed learning technology, as you may have guessed from the subhead. And this is based a lot of it on a course that, a MOOC that I did last fall, October to December, called E-Learning 3.0. So 3.0, third wave, you get the idea. Everything's still up, that's the URL for it, and I didn't check to see what happens if I click on a URL, but let's experiment together. And it's Apple, so nothing happens. Cannot locate the internet server. Okay, no internet for you. All right. But you can go there after. And we explored what really is, as the title says, a third wave of educational technology, a third wave of doing education in general. Now let me talk briefly about those waves. So the first wave is the wave that many colleges and universities are still in. Web 1, we might call it. The client-server model, the learning management system, learning resources or learning objects, the traditional picture of open educational resources, for that matter. The idea of online learning as content delivery, the idea of education as content delivery or content transfer, if you will. Educational technology characterized by things like sequencing, learning design, roles, all of that. Shareable courseware object reference model, updated to shareable content object reference model from ADL. Content repositories, and I think we still talk about those. And it was called, in the words of J. Cross, e-learning. So that was the first wave. Second wave came along and it was, well, cool. I loved it. In retrospect, we can call it the platform model. And as the picture suggests, we were still interacting with servers, but now the servers could communicate with each other and act as platforms for other services. So the learning management systems transitioned into learning platforms. And you talk to people, for example, at Desire to Learn, don't call it a learning management system, they get very upset. Technologies like application programming interfaces or representational state transfers were used to communicate between web servers. Social networks sprang up. The idea of the web consumer as a producer or the prosumer, right? In the world of educational technologies, we got learning tools, interoperability, so we could launch applications from our learning platform. Learning design, recognition networks, content curation, and as I called it back 2004, e-learning 2.0. Third wave. This is what's coming. It's pretty much here. It hasn't hit yet. But all of this stuff that I'm talking about is here. This isn't future prediction. It's just I'm looking at a big towering wall of water and saying what will happen. And it's not hard to say what will happen. Parts of it, open data services, open data networks, cloud services, graphs, graph technology, graph logic, graph algorithms, something called sovereign identity, sharing networks, recognition instead of tests and exams, consensus, experience as creativity, agency, and what I call e-learning 3.0. I wanted to call it something else because when I coined the term e-learning 2.0, I said, there will be a third e-learning, but it won't be called e-learning 3.0. But I couldn't think of anything like learn 3? No, just anyhow. So that's, this is the distributed model, and this is the topic of the talk today. Now, the way I've set this up is in three sections. They're not waves, they might be ripples, maybe. First of all, I'm going to talk about the technology, then I'm going to talk about the pedagogy. Finally, I'm going to talk about outcomes, what we want from the system. And for each of these three sections, I'm going to talk about some what I'm calling big ideas. Now, when I say big idea, I don't necessarily mean it's my big idea, although I'd love to take credit for them. But I've learned from experience that anything I've done that I thought was actually original, not so much. Somebody has already done it. So that's fine. I don't mind that. But they are big ideas, and I think they are important ideas. So we'll begin with the first big idea. A course, has open data. Now this is a map of the e-learning 3.0 course that we offered in the fall. And you notice it doesn't look like module 1, module 2, module 3 with contents. Now it did have modules, it did have sections and things like that. But the overall structure of the course was data. And that's how I thought of the course, and that's how I wanted people to think of the course. It wasn't a narrative. We weren't telling a story. We were presenting people with basically a connected network of data. It's hard to think of a course as data. We think of a course, we think of content generally as maybe a set of premises working through to a conclusion or an explanation or definitions or some such thing, you know, a logical structure. But these are not necessarily structured, or more accurately, the structure is put onto the data by the user based on the context in which he or her is operating. So I can't actually open Grasshopper, but Grasshopper is the application that I used to offer the course. It's a tool I've been working on for a long time. It's a tool I used to create the first MOOC. And this evolves very gently, naturally, out of the MOOC idea. It is basically the MOOC. And if you look along the left-hand side, that's the course contents. But the course contents, again, is data. So badges, boxes, channels, chats. The course itself is just a piece of data. And in fact, that's why I put the question mark in course. Really, from this perspective, could be a course, might not be a course, could just be some learning resources, whatever. Course, in this context, is just a piece of data associated with a bunch of other pieces of data. That's big idea number one. Big idea number two is courses, or whatever, in containers. I could go on for several days talking about this. There's a huge pile of technology out there about containers. The idea is really simple. Take a computer, say this barely functioning Macintosh computer here, and you have, you know, the motherboard and the CPU and all of that, and then there's the screen and the keyboard, the devices you interoperate with it. Take all of those, the screen, the keyboard, and remove the hardware and just put in, you know, a little software emulator. So you're pretending to the computer that this is a keyboard, this is a mouse, whatever. Well, that's basically what we do with virtualization. It's like a computer, but instead of being, you know, self-contained hardware unit like this, we put it in a software box, and then we emulate, using software, the hardware interface, the keyboard, the screen, etc. So that seems like a pretty neat idea. In fact, it is a pretty neat idea. One of the, you know, computing hosting providers use this all the time. They have one machine, and they have a whole bunch of virtual computers on that machine for internet service accounts, etc. Of course, you can run these machines in your machine, and a lot of people do that. So I tried to create something last year called Grasshopper in a Box, where I put Grasshopper, which is my MOOC system, into a container. It was made out of Vagrant. And I presented that at a conference in Berlin. And it worked, but it didn't work great. A lot of my experiments are like that. They work, but they don't work great. So I didn't enable that for this course, but it's still something that I'd like to do. But the next step of that is, why put an entire computer with all of the stuff into a box? Why not just have part of a computer, the part that does precisely what you're doing? So suppose I wanted to use Photoshop, or just put Photoshop emulated, of course, and whatever parts of the operating system I need for Photoshop. So I sort of have like part of a container, part of a computer. So that's like putting it in a container. So now I can actually create kind of a little, collection of containers and have an application running on different computers all on my computer. That's horrible. So for example, take a web server. I could have the web server and one emulated computer all for the server itself. I can have the database in a different container. I can have the video conferencing thing in another container. And then these containers communicate together to create the entire course. Well, now we're on to something. And this is, in fact, what universities, developers, the web as a whole is doing. Almost, I don't want to say almost all the things, but many of the services that you access today are being accessed not from an actual computer, but from a container service being run in a place like, say, Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud, Microsoft Azure, and there are some others, DigitalOcean, etc. So we experimented with that to a degree in the e-learning 3.0 course, just trying to get a handle on the idea that we could create an entire web server in approximately 30 seconds if we wanted, and we could expand that web server as much as we wanted. So, courses in containers. So, here's the impact of that is, we don't need to depend on single centralized servers anymore. There's a movement out there called re-decentralizing the web. It's something that the indie web people are keen on. It's something that the founder of the web, Tim Berners-Lee, is keen on. It's something that I'm keen on. We've seen the centralized web applications, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc., and they are broken. And they're broken in ways that seem impossible to fix, especially impossible to fix from within the application. You can't fix Facebook from within Facebook. So we have decentralized web applications where the photo gallery might be here, my calendar might be here, my contact list might be here, etc. And one of them might be on Docker, another one might be on Amazon Web Services, or I just might be sharing computers with my friends, or it just might be computers scattered around my house, whatever. All of these things are in containers, and the containers are interacting with each other. So that's kind of cool. Okay. I've already alluded to big idea number 3, graph, not story. The traditional model of learning, the traditional model of organization of educational technology is narrative. Start at the beginning, go to the end. From the perspective of a network, from the perspective of a graph, though, a narrative is just one way of traversing the graph, going from point to point to point. It might not even be the best way, and it's certainly not the only way. And it might not be the appropriate way to look at graphs generally. But also, when you're working with narratives, when you're working with models, what you're focusing on in general, not always, is the common practice, the best practice. your average, I don't want to say you're averaging, but you're averaging, or you're grading on a curve. If you're using traditional machine learning, statistical analysis, pretty much anything based on numbers, you're capturing that big bump in the middle. But networks work differently. Networks are organized not according to the mean, not according to the curve, but according to what's called a power law. And you've probably heard of power laws from discussions of social networks, etc., in the past. A power law distribution has, in some cases, some parts of the network are very densely connected, and other parts of the network, which we call the long tail, are sparsely connected. And what's significant about this is that the outliers, the unexpected, these are as important as the averages or the mean, and in fact, sometimes more important. I think that this has a significant bearing on, well, on education generally and educational technology in particular. We tend to design for a particular outcome in technology, a use case in education, a content or a curriculum. I prefer to design for the possibility, whatever that is, the outlier, the unknown, the thing that might happen but we know nothing about. So I prefer to present everything as the graph where the listener, the reader, the consumer interprets the graph in their own way, according to their own perception, according to their own needs, their own backgrounds, their own previous experience. I'm not explaining that as well as I would like, but I'm trying to combine things together here. So I hope this is making sense. Give me a nod if this is making sense. Oh, good. all right. So, this is how the web is reorganizing itself now, as linked open data. This has all kinds of implications. This is what it looked like in 2009. If you click on that link today, and I was sort of hoping to, you get this huge cloud of linked data, 10 times the size of that. The circles are tiny. And it's this densely connected cloud of data. All that is stuff that exists today. All of that is the data, the raw material for our online courses today. And it's hard to think of two things that are more separated than courses as texts and course packages and all of that, and then this whole web of linked data that's out there, organized but unorganized, perceivable but unperceived, usable but for the most part unused. And if you think about it, each one of these things, US Census data, BBC programming, symbol, just says symbol, I don't know what it is. DBpedia, etc. Flickr wrapper, all of these things are running in their own containers. All of these things have their own open APIs. All of these things can be accessed, indeed can be part of your course. And that's what I tried to do with eLearning 3.0. EL30, except I didn't access all of that because I'm just not a good enough programmer yet. But we created our own web, just like in the traditional MOOC, where each individual had their own bubble in the network, and we connected all of those. So the idea was that there was not one location for eLearning 3.0. There were, I guess, I'm not sure exactly how many there were. There were multiple locations for eLearning 3.0. I had one, and each of the participants who contributed their blog posts, their comments, whatever, they had their own places, their own locations. Ultimately, long term, all of these become data sources. What I wanted to do, and wasn't really successful at, so there's a bit of a hit and miss in my talk too, going with the conference themes. I wanted the people taking the course to each have their own instance of Grasshopper. So they would each have their own data network, and they could create their own content, whatever they wanted them to be. The way Grasshopper is set up, right now, you can create a course, an event, a presentation, whatever, but the idea is that you can create any data element you want, it doesn't matter. And the idea here was that individuals in the course could create their own data structure however they wanted. And then these data structures would interact, would be connected with the Grasshopper 3.0 course data structure, and it would all become one big distributed web. So a few people downloaded and installed Grasshopper, but we never really got the interoperability working. But you know, it's a tantalizing thing that's out there. This idea of having individuals with their own linked open data networks interoperating with each other. Tantalizing, not quite there. So the technology underlying these, and this goes beyond what I've been able to do in Grasshopper, is based on different kinds of data structures. You can see three major types of these data structures here. One is called a directed acyclic graph, that's the DAG. Blockchain, which is one that you're probably familiar with, at least in the media. And then on the far right, something called a hash graph. Now, they're all very similar kinds of structures. And these structures are in the process of beginning to underlie all of those data structures that I just showed you. This is a transition that's happening now. It hasn't happened yet. So, whoops. As I'll mention in a section to come, the idea here is that these data elements are connected by means of what we call hashes. And a hash is a way of allowing for these networks to be distributed across multiple computers, multiple containers, multiple people, but nonetheless still maintain their integrity and their identity. Talk about that in just a bit. So that's kind of a convoluted way of getting at the underlying technology. So, by the eyes glazed over, and by the fact that we're in kind of an educational audience, the question is, well, yeah, but so what? Even if it had been better explained, I'm not sure why this would have been relevant to me. And that's fair enough. So there are also some big ideas, even bigger ideas, related to pedagogy. Here's the first one. Content addressable resources for education. These are, I argue, the future open educational resources. These will replace what we think of open educational resources today. Why is that? Well, for one thing, open educational resources are all about this narrative, this structure, this learning resource kind of thing. But even more to the point, an open educational resource is defined by its licensing, right? It's open because it's licensed to be open. And so, you know, me versus David Wiley, all kinds of huge arguments about licensing, what counts as commercial use, etc. In CARE, what makes it a member of a CARE network, or CARENET, is the way the resource is put together, structured, and identified. So it works a lot like something you may have heard of, GitHub. Have you heard of GitHub? Yeah. So in GitHub is a directed acyclic network, or DAG. I just showed you a DAG. And the idea here is that each individual item has its own address. You write a piece of software, it has its own address. You change that piece of software, you don't change the original piece of software. Rather, you create an entirely new piece of software that is basically a copy of the original plus your change. And then if you change it again, you do the same thing. So you never overwrite old data, right? Anytime you make a change, you create a completely new copy, a completely new copy. And these copies are linked together in this directional acyclic graph. Now there's a whole bunch more to GitHub than that, a whole bunch more to Git than that, but that's the basic idea. And so the question comes, well, how do you keep track? How does it work? Well, each iteration of a program, each piece of content, each whatever, is given its own unique address, which is, as the slide says, a hash of its content. What does that mean? Take some data, whatever it is, run that data through an encryption algorithm known as a hash algorithm. And then out the other end of that algorithm pops a string of characters, which is the hash or the key for that content. Now these keys are very short, and you'll probably run into duplicates. But if you make the key long enough, 256 bytes, say, then your keys will never be duplicated. Because there'll be more keys than there are atoms in the universe. What that means is that each piece of content has a different key. And that key is bound to the content. Change the content, change the key. Take War and Peace, the novel. Run it through the algorithm, you get a key, a hash. Change one comma in War and Peace, run it through the algorithm, you get a different hash. Link these two hashes together in a third hash, and you've got your directed acyclic graph. Cool, eh? That's the future of open educational resources. Because if we do that, if we create our open educational resources as our data, remember data, this is the beginning of all things, and give them hashes, now we can have an open educational resource, somebody changes it, it gets traced back, new open educational resource, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need licensing, we don't need any of that. All we need is for it to be in this graph. So, content, addressable resource for education, the new OER. Now, GitHub is a centralized site. We wanted to do away with centralization. That's quite true. But think about it now. Previously, our open educational resources were identifiable by a domain name, a URL, an address, right? Telling you where to find it. www.downs.ca/presentation/505. That's where to find this presentation when it's done. That's a specific location on the internet. You have to access a specific server. If that server is down or blocked or has a paywall or a spam wall, you can't access that content. Put a tuition wall around it and then close it, you can't access that content. Terrible system. Okay, it worked really well for a while. But now we have a way of identifying resources by their hash, which means it doesn't matter where it is anymore. You can have a copy, you can have a copy, you can have a copy. We can each, all of us in this room can have a copy of that resource. And we put it in our own file structure, however we want. But it'll always have the key, which is the hash of that resource. And the key will be the same on all of our computers. So now suppose I'm looking for that resource. I don't need to go to the original server anymore. I just ask you, have you got that resource? If you do, you give me the resource. If you don't, you refer me to your friend. I ask you, do you have that resource? If you do, you give me the resource, and so on. We traverse the graph until I find one of you who has that resource. Now, what I've just described is something called the interplanetary file system, which really exists. And in the course, the eLearning 3.0 course, I actually created the first and currently only content addressable resource for education, the first instance of CARE, which was the a PowerPoint presentation with the NRC vision and mission statement, and put that in CARE. It has its own address. It's out there forever now. If somebody changes that, it'll have a different address. Right? It wouldn't be the same anymore. So this is a really important security feature, because now, suppose you come along, you ask for, I want that particular resource, and you ask the network out there, can you give me a copy of that particular resource? Somebody gives it to you, how do you know you got the right thing? How do you know you didn't get the vision and mission statement for CSIS instead of NRC? Who'd know, right? You run the resource through the hash algorithm again. If the output of that algorithm is the same as the address of the resource, you know you got the right resource. If it's not the same, you know you got the wrong resource, throw it away. So there's somebody's trying to give you fake content. So it's not only distributed, it's securely distributed. And that's how we can know, that's how we can trace provenance, adaptations, changes, forks, branches. And instead of trying to converge around one single idea of licensing or whatever, we each of us create, share, change, amend, etc., our own resources. I think that's a pretty neat idea. If you can think of it as a distributed GitHub for learning resources. Just a mental image. It's not exactly the same, but it's sort of the same. IPFS right now is agonizingly slow. If I started to load a resource at the start of this presentation, it might still be loading. That's because the network is sparse. Not too many people are using it. It's one of these things, the more people use it, the better it's going to work. But right now, it's pretty slow. These resources, now they're all easily accessible. Now they're all out there in this network. We don't need to create them ourselves anymore. This is kind of like a big idea, subset of a big idea. This is a poem. It was seeded with those first four lines in bold. The artificial intelligence wrote the rest of it. It's not so great. But there was one written by the same authors, Kevin Hodgson, which really was quite good. I was impressed by it. And this is just part of what's out there. There's another services, an AI that automatically writes patent applications for you. there's another one out there that, it's just in my notes here, stupid Macintosh. It doesn't scroll like a real computer. there's an article I linked to in my newsletter a little while back. Microsoft wants to put their entire software development program on an artificial intelligence, so AIs will write software. NRC actually has a program that's starting up called AI in Design. Not really my thing, but it's kind of neat. There's more. In a talk I did recently, I gave them some samples of AI-generated music. There's a service out there that generates death metal 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. It never ends. As death metal goes, not so great. But then again, it never ends. So imagine our open educational resources, or our educational resources generally, being created by an AI using this huge web of linked data. Kind of raises the question, well, what do we do? Well, we do what Kevin did. We work with the AI, right? It's not about, and other people have said, it's not about AIs replacing people. It's about AIs and people working together. But, you know, it means that we have different things to learn to do. We have different capacities that we need. We need a different way of thinking about things. We need to be thinking in terms of data, not narrative. We need to be thinking in terms of clouds and containers and connected things out there. We need to be thinking about the graph and how a graph works, etc. And just touch the surface of all of these things, but we need to be thinking about these things in more depth than I can touch on in a 1 hour talk. Big idea number five, therefore, is the idea of content and creation combined. We don't just get content anymore. We used to, we still do. I mean, you're getting content now, although if you yelled at me, we'd be creating it together. See, there you go. Well, it's kind of a sad yell. This is Banksy, of course. I love Banksy. Any guy who shreds his own artwork at the point of sale is my hero. you know, the whole idea of content creation combined in context is brilliant, and it's our future. It's our students' future. The idea that we would give them content to remember is like, that's wave one, right? We, in the future, are not giving them content at all, or at least not content the way we thought of it, but content that they actually create themselves. What do I mean? Well, we learn from experience, you know, from practice, and we learn from reflection. This is old news to all of you. And what's happening is that technologies are being developed now, being used now, to combine that experience. A good example is Fortnite. There are different iterations of Fortnite out there. I'm not really a Fortnite aficionado. I like No Man's Sky, but different genre. But with Fortnite, you go in there, you get shot, and normally that's where your game would end. But you stay in there and you watch everybody else. It's at once something you play, at another time something you watch. And then you create the recording, you watch the recording, it all smooshes into one. There's a whole bunch of things coming out like that, where the creation of the content is part of the content. Livecaster for webcasting. People are using this to webcast their games. I've webcast my No Man's Sky games. Now, unfortunately, I'm served by Bell. In the country, and so my output game so thank you, Bell. I hope to move into the 21st century with you sometime in the future. Twitch, you've heard of Twitch, right? You're playing the game, you're broadcasting the game. Content and creation is one. Open broadcaster, same kind of thing. It's an open source broadcasting suite. You can be broadcasting live. Or on Windows, you have to do some installation. If I hit the Windows key and the G key, I'm streaming. That's all it takes. And I'm streaming out to the Windows network or somewhere. I do lots of live streams with YouTube. In our course, we did lots of live streaming with YouTube because why not? Content and creation as one. We can take that way further. Notebooks, something called Jupyter Notebook. Jupyter Notebook is a neat thing. It's like a text document, but inside that text document are some blocks that access a container, and inside that block is a piece of computer code. Okay. What the container does is run that computer code for you. So you're reading something, you see some code, there's a little arrow key or button, hit the arrow button, that code executes. And then the output from that code displays in the notebook. It's run by the container, it comes back out to the notebook. It's called a Jupyter Notebook. The thing is, these are real computer programs, right? They're running in an emulator, but they can access live data out there in the world. So this notebook actually runs a little bit differently every time somebody runs it. Even better, when you're reading the notebook, you don't just read the notebook and run the program, because that would be boring. You read the notebook, run the program, then you change the program however you want. You run the program again, it runs the program as you've written it. Or it crashes if you made a mistake. Welcome to my experience. Content and creativity combine. Now, these notebooks can be content addressable resources for education, because why not? Workbench, similar kind of thing. Free and open source data journalism, it accesses this, you know, open linked data, and then web journalists, data journalists can work with this data, clean it, analyze it, visualize it, do all the things that you do with data. Or your students could do this. Big idea number six, we are the content. There's a little video there. Of course, the meaning is the message, and that must mean the audience. The content is the audience. Anyhow, I can't be Marshall McLuhan. We are the content. The content isn't the content. The content is a MacGuffin. The content is filler. The content is whatever's around today, right? However number many of planets, pretend I didn't say that sentence. However many planets we think there are today, that's the content. Could change tomorrow. It's changed, well, once, I guess, only in my lifetime. And I'm still annoyed by it. But. When I say we are the content, I mean that actually quite literally. The outcome of education isn't remembering or anything like that. The outcome of an education is a person. In particular, most precisely, the outcome of an education is an organization of the person such that they are able to recognize patterns in graphs, or patterns generally, because I think everything is a graph. Pattern recognition. Another way of looking at it, not dissimilar, is to think of the individual as a graph, but not just a graph of neural networks, but as what's called an identity graph. This is a concept from advertising, horrible, evil people. And what they would do is they look at all of the different social networks, Facebook, Twitter, etc., all of the web tracking that they do, and they would over time associate these to build a graph that they conclude is a single individual person. And that's called an identity graph. The idea here is you do it instead of the advertiser, and you control it instead of the advertiser. Following on this is the concept of self-sovereign identity, the idea of controlling your own identity. The way it works now, other people control your identity, whether it's the government, the university with your university account, the driver's license bureau, Microsoft, Twitter, Apple, each with different and inconsistent identities that advertisers are working hard to associate. Instead, self-sovereign identity is a single owned identity secured by asymmetric encryption or keys, and you might even just have them on your keychain. They'll just plug into your computer or use RFID to connect to your computer or Bluetooth or whatever. And then you carry that same identity from place to place to place, releasing only as much data about yourself as you want to. And it allows us to define our own picture of ourselves. This is a diagram created by one of the students in the course, Jenny McNess, an identity graph of herself. And you notice how when we start thinking of ourselves in terms of these identity graphs, instead of, say, grades and tests or whatever, we get a very different picture, right? We get consultancy, teaching, Norfolk, cycling, Flickr, Cotswolds, whatever, all kinds of data. It's a different picture of a person. It's a different understanding of a person. It's not just a bunch of numbers. It's a bunch of connected things. All of these things associated with all of the creativity that they did, sorry about the bad grammar, out there in the world. Which leads us to outcomes. AI-based learning recognition. Right now, the big thing is competencies. If it hasn't hit your college or university yet, it will. Probably has. Advanced distributed learning has their competencies and skill systems. Everybody wants to do competencies. Industry wants to do competencies. Now, there's a whole bunch of narratives, a whole bunch of stories related to that. The main thing a focus on competencies does is it means that we're changing the outcome of learning from content knowledge, which is the traditional outcome, to capacities and skills. And these are tested differently, these are recognized differently. And as a result, if you change your focus in that way, then we don't need to rely on tests and exams. And there goes cheating, who cares? There goes the cheating detection services. We don't need those anymore because there aren't tests anymore or essays anymore. And what you're being recognized on is your quantified self, or your qualified self, whatever that happens to be. And traditionally, humans have done that recognizing. The head doctor would look at the performance of an intern and say, yes, I recognize that this person has the skills. They could itemize them, but you know and I know. You look at somebody performing something, if you're an expert in that, you know right away whether they are qualified or not. You can run them through the test, but you pretty much know. We can talk about that. There's a lot of talk about badges and micro-credentials. Temporary. I set up a whole badging system for eLearning 3.0, not because I felt that I needed it, but because I wanted to interoperate with data. So it interoperated with Badger. I sent notifications to individual people using a piece of indie web technology called Web Mentions. I even wrote a blockchain application and saved the badges onto that blockchain. So I thought, that's pretty cool, totally unnecessary, but still pretty cool. But the whole idea here wasn't to write badges or micro-credentials to these things. The whole idea was to write data to these things. If I can write data to these things, now I have a mechanism where I can save the creative output of people in the course in such a way that A, it can be read by an artificial intelligence or a person or a combination, and recognized as quality learning or whatever, and B, secure. It's stored as a hash graph, which is all a blockchain is, stored as a hash graph so that you know if you're getting that data from that source, that data is an accurate representation of what happened in the course. No plagiarism, no testing services. Now, advanced distributed learning is trying to do kind of the same thing with activity records and something called the Experience API. But learning record stores really are just stores of triples, stores of statements about a person's activities, and they don't come via the person themselves, they come via the learning management system, or I should say the learning platform, right? So somebody else is running your activities, your activity records for you. But we don't need to depend on that. We can recognize learning today as the totality of a person's activities in the world, as managed and controlled by that person. And that's the key thing here, right? It's not that you're snooping on somebody inside this siloed or centralized application. Rather, this person is projecting themselves into the world through the different forms of their creativity. And that is what the AI is relying on. That is what the expert or the instructor or the assessor is relying on. And it's not just performance inside a single course or inside a single LMS, but anywhere out there in the world. Big idea number 8, almost there. Community as consensus, or community is consensus. This is a very different picture of community than the one we have now. This is the idea that what brings us together isn't the commonalities that we have, it isn't the shared vision, it isn't the place that we live, it isn't a language or a culture or a religion. Rather, it's that we share a mechanism for agreeing on what's true and what's not true. What is the state of affairs in the world and what is not? I often say fake news is a consensus problem, not a fake news problem. Fake news is not a literacy problem. You can't fix it by being smarter. You fix it by amending the mechanisms you use to create consensus and community. This is a hard, hard topic, and I've got negative time to talk about it in. Truth, for any of us, for all of us, begins with personal experience. Period, end of story. And in fact, when we look at consensus in the wider world, we have to begin with the presumption that we cannot trust anyone. In the world of technology, this is called the Byzantine General's problem. You are connected to a network of what you think are trusted advisors, but they're Byzantines. They might be lying. And that's true today, right? We're connected to a whole range of news sources, of content sources, etc. Some of them are telling the truth, some of them are not. Some of them are bad actors. Some of them are malicious. Some of them just want to burn things down. We don't know who's who. And the difficulty is, how do we reach consensus as a society? The key thing that blockchain has done is to show that you can do this. Now, they might not have found the best method. They certainly haven't found the most efficient method, but they have found a method. And knowing that there is a method suggests to us that there may be other methods. There's a whole range of consensus algorithms under the heading of Paxos algorithms. If you look it up, Paxos is a mythical Greek society. But the question is, on what will our consensus algorithms be based? On work, stake, importance, authority? These are all existing consensus algorithm methods today. These are open questions still. These are questions about how we will define our society. This is the outcome of our educational system, this method of consensus, which leads us to big idea number 9, redefining success. We used to think success was a person graduates, they have a body of knowledge. That right now is, I'm trying to think of all the as useless as, you know, as useless as a screen door in a submarine. As useless as a fish with a propeller. Actually, that'd probably be pretty useful. Success is, in my world anyways, agency. Success, now what is agency? Well, we borrow here from Open Text BC, chapter 17, Government and Politics. Agency is the relative standing of an individual with respect to community institutions and governments. It could be Maslow's hierarchy, it could be, I don't know what, right? But agency. Well, there are different ways of defining this. One way that I settled on a little while back was 4 key outcomes: security, identity, voice, and opportunity. Security, everything from getting a job to knowing you will be able to live, but also, you know, security of the person, security of the self. There's all kinds of securities. Identity, you know, everything up to and including the pronoun buttons, which I applaud, by the way. The idea of identity is that we can have an identity, is the first one of the, I was going to say the first freedom, but one of the first freedoms. Voice, the ability to express oneself, the ability to be creative, the ability indeed to learn through creation. And then opportunity, as John Stuart Mill would say, for each of us to fulfill our own good in our own way. Now, you might disagree with those. That's cool. I don't mind. You might have your own ideas of outcomes. But I'll tell you, outcomes aren't anymore a person has acquired knowledge of a body of content. Our world is changing too rapidly for that to be of any use, and we have far more urgent things that we need to have as outcomes. And these are among them. Just the capacity as an agent in our society to take part in the forming of the consensus that defines our society, whatever that is, however that's defined. Agency. To my mind, education needs to focus, if there is a focus, on the tools and the capacities for agencies. The literacies, pattern recognition in graphs, cognition, you know, basic reasoning and inference, understanding change, etc. The values that represent a graph or a network that can indeed reach a consensus, which I've stated in the past, are things like autonomy, diversity, openness, interactivity. And then the skills required to operate as a member of a network, as a member of a graph, as a member of a society, working toward reaching and defining consensus. What you want out of education really is based on how you define education. If you think of education as instruction, then what people will learn is how to be instructed. If you think of education as discovery, then the outcome of education will be how to discover. If you think of education as constructivism, then the outcome will be how to construct. If you think of education as connectivism, then the outcome will be how to connect. And if you think of education, if you think of learning as free learning, then the outcome will be how to be free. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. So we are As a way of saying thank you, I don't need the microphone. We're providing Stephen with a gift from local artists.
Thank you.
A whale, an orca, and an eagle on a recycled glass plate to be environmentally friendly, sort of representing the regional artwork that is available here.
Do you want me to show people?
You certainly can. Now we have 15 minutes for show and tell, and then we'll move on to the sessions.
I like showing people because now I hide these in. This is nice.
Wow.
And you can get them from Corrine Hunt.
Horseshoe Bay, if you're interested. It's a bit of a drive.
Beautiful. So, thank you.
Stephen, thank you very much for setting us up for thinking about e-learning 4.0 or new original terms. I hope you all were inspired and are eager to get on to other sessions and discuss the future of learning. Thank you for showing up early this morning. We'll see you during the sessions.